like I said, by me taking them Valiums, you know, you get to the point to where you just don't care, right? So I'm sitting there like, man, I'm helping these people, send me to prison.
You know, Reginald lost 34 years of his life, but, you know, the second part of that is that they ignored evidence of the likely murderer.
Your job is to protect yourself at any cost. And basically, that's what I was doing. I had a weapon and everything go with it. It ain't about the money. It's about being free and be able to make choices. He wanted to kill the police for his life. I kept that away from my report. I kept that from being spoken. Because I like the guy, I don't want to see him fried. You know, because he was a young 24-year-old black kid, and I can understand black kids hating cops.
The police, you know, overlooked the real murderer.
Imagine police officers taking you into an interrogation room, drugging you, and then framing you for a murder you didn't commit. A tale from the Third Reich, Syria, or North Korea? Try New Orleans. That's what happened to Reginald Adams, who served 34 years in Angola Penitentiary for a crime he never committed.
Like I said, by me taking them Valiums, you know, you get to the point to where you just don't care, right? So I'm sitting there like, man, I'm helping these people, send me to prison. But, you know, the thing, like I say, was what made it so bad was like, after all that was said and done, I was like, man, damn, I don't know nothing about no murder, man. But anyways, I was like almost like helping them send me to prison. And I'm like, wow. So after that was over with, I thought about it. I said, damn, man, I ain't killed nobody, man. But, you know, my biggest threat was like, I don't know, just trying to get the Seafood City Burger over with. And I thought at the time, you know, when they were telling me that, was like, you take this, they try to get me the cop out and all that.
Corruption on the New Orleans police force is hardly surprising. It has been the subject of countless government and newspaper investigations, and even the subject of a few movies. Movies like The Big Easy.
We got the bribery conviction locked up.
I don't know. It just skirts the edge of entrapment. If you get the wrong judge, you'll throw the case out.
Maybe you'll want to make a deal.
Yeah, I knew you were the right guy to talk to.
I don't think we should offer a deal now. I think we should get a conviction. Then we can offer a deal.
That's my way of saying thanks.
And I want you to ask for very high bail. Let him sweat.
Or the movie Heaven's Prisoners.
He's asking the right people.
I am in town to find out about a guy. I think he might have come in here.
A lot of guys come in here.
The wrong questions.
I hear Johnny Dantes was working for the feds.
That make you nervous?
I can see in your baby blue eyes you wish to love to take me.
Finding out too much.
I know, you're right. You're a cop.
Nope.
So is this the way it's going to be? While you're off, you're living the past. I'm here with a child pretending we have a family.
I'm out there protecting that family.
And learning too late that the life he saved,
you got to pay the man,
could cost him his own.
I'm going to find those two men, and when I do, I'm going to squeeze them extra hard.
When you mess with the action in New Orleans, you mess with hundreds of people.
You're not afraid of Bubba. You know he's not really so tough.
Nobody is going to cool out in my action.
But for Reginald Adams, corruption in the New Orleans Police Department wasn't Hollywood make-believe. It was all too real. On October 7, 1979, Kathy Ulfers, a 24-year-old woman, was shot 7 times in her New Orleans home where she died. The pretty blonde was the daughter of a retired New Orleans police major and the wife of police officer Ronald Ulfers. Because of family ties to the department, it may have been handled differently than other homicides. Adams' attorney Mike Magner, a former federal prosecutor, said the most obvious person to have been a suspect in the murder was the victim's husband.
I think they were. The real problem, though, is, you know, and the problem with all of this is that the police, you know, overlooked the real murderer. You know, as we know in hindsight, you know, Ronald Ulfers, the policeman, was convicted of murdering his second wife. And the, you know, the detectives in Reginald's case had a lot of evidence, you know, to link Ulfers with Kathy Ulfers' murder that they ignored. You know, they had evidence that he had threatened her. They had evidence that, you know, within a day or two of Kathy's murder, that, you know, he had basically chopped up her divorce lawyer's car, and they had found the stolen car parts, you know, in his home and in some other property that, that he controlled. They knew that that Kathy had threatened to divorce Ronald. They knew that, you know, Ronald was, you know, in all likelihood having an affair. And, I mean, that's the real shocker in all this, is that they had very solid leads, you know, relative to the husband, and that they ignored. You know, they also found the murder weapon, in what all likelihood was the murder weapon. I think some of the reports have since been destroyed. But the report that, you know, the Innocence Project found in the DA's files indicated that they found the murder weapon, that it tested to be the murder weapon, and it was found in possession of someone that that Reginald doesn't know and has never, you know, had never run into before. So that's the, you know, I mean, the obvious, you know, sad part of all this is that, you know, Reginald lost 34 years of his life. But, you know, the second part of that is that they ignored evidence of the likely murderer.
The case was investigated by two detectives, Martin Venezia and Sam Gebbia. Gebbia has since died. Venezia has left the department but insists that Reginald Adams is guilty.
He wanted to kill a policeman's wife. That's my absolute personal opinion based upon a lot of experience of life and knowing criminals. And I kept that away from my report. I kept that from being spoken because I like the guy. I don't want to see him fried. You know, because he was a young 24-year-old black kid, and I can understand black kids hating cops.
About a month after the murder, a gun was recovered and tested. The ballistic test found it to be an exact match for the weapon used in the slaying of Kathy Ulfers. The gun's ownership was linked to a brother and sister, Alice and Roland Burns. The pair had no connection to Reginald Adams. Two witnesses told the detectives that 2 days after the murder, Roland Burns tried to sell them a ring identical to the one stolen from the Ulfers' home. The detectives found evidence that Alice Burns had access to the gun the day before the murder, and that on the day of the murder, she was staying at a motel 2.5 miles from the Ulfers' home. The police initially detained Roland Burns, but then let him go. Detective Martin Venezia said he confronted his commanding officer and said he believed that Roland Burns was being framed by the police department.
I got to tell you flat out, I've been telling this to Sam from the beginning, I refuse to arrest Roland Burns for murder. He is not guilty of the murder. That gun is not the murder weapon. There's no duplicate ring. That bracelet does not belong to any office. This is a frame, and I refuse to do anything. And Captain, you said, Remy says, I am to understand that. We'll just write you out the report and let you go back to your platoon.
I said, so who were they framing exactly?
What?
Who were they framing? Were they framing Reginald?
Roland Burns. Roland Burns.
Okay, gotcha.
Roland Burns.
Okay.
Roland Burns.
Okay.
Roland Burns. Okay?
Okay, I gotcha.
So when he says that, which is really generous. I mean, real generous. It was very generous. So I turn around, start walking, and I go about 10, 15 seconds, and I stop. And I said, they're still going to continue and book this guy. I can't allow it. So I turned around and walked back. By that time, he was just going to his office to make his phone call upstairs. I'm assuming notify the superintendent or whoever was running the operation. I'm sure the superintendent did not run the operation. I got to figure out, he got his assistant, Graham Martin, to run it. So I walk into Ronnie. I said, look, I can't do this. I said, please let them know that if they charge Roland Burns with murder, I will notify OIDP, it's an Orange Independent Program, within 10 minutes. the subpoena me to the very next court appearance, which would be like within 24 hours, it's required. And I said, and I'm gonna give them a list of questions they asked me, and I'm gonna live off all this bullshit. This is a total sack of crap, and I'm not gonna allow it. I'm not gonna allow this man to be charged with murder who is totally fucking innocent. If there's not one legitimate piece of evidence that exists, this is a frame job.
But attorney Mike Magner said Venezia isn't credible.
He's given some wild explanations, none of which make a whole lot of sense. You know, and his stories have been so inconsistent that it really is difficult to understand exactly what it is that he's claiming. But, you know, he admits to some portions of the homicide report that we were able to uncover that would show his knowledge, you know, of all these other, you know, suspects, but then, you know, denies knowledge of other aspects. So it's very difficult to pin him down on his story. But yeah, I think he had a serious drug and alcohol problem. We're not entirely sure when that manifested itself, but he did have a conviction for vehicular homicide and, you know, had been, you know, booted off the police department.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for something healthy to eat. And the problem is, I don't always eat healthy. If it was left up to me, I'd be sitting in front of the TV eating corn chips. And that's because I don't plan very well. And it's an effort to go out into store and hunt down healthy things to eat. But hey, you can get healthy things delivered to your home to dine on. And these aren't meals. These are just snacks. Healthy snack food. What a concept. The company I'm talking about is Hungry Root. They were founded back in 2015. Hungry Root is a brand of healthy comfort food. They take foods that people associate with indulgence and lack of health and reinvent them using vegetables and other wholesome ingredients. And they'll deliver them to your house every week. Think of them as the healthy convenience food company. They deliver weekly boxes of foods that customers can use to make a variety of inspiring, delicious dishes. All their food is plant-based and gluten-free. Their meals come either ready to eat or ready in less than 10 minutes. Customers can choose to make the dishes according to the recipes that are provided or mix and match ingredients for additional flexibility. They offer over 75 dishes that customers can make at home, like sweet potato pad thai made from sweet potato noodles, spicy peanut sauce, and snap peas. I'm just saying, that is just absolutely delicious. And then there's the almond chip pea cookie dough. I can't wait to serve this up for my three daughters. They love ice cream. And the idea that I could fool them and get them to eat something healthy that they're also going to think is indulgent, I just think is so awesome. And you can even eat it straight from the container, folks. There are no commitments to working with Hungry Root. You can skip a weekly box when you don't need it. And folks, there are just so many people out there that love it. It's gotten a 4.6 Facebook rating. You can't do much better than that. It is just exceptionally popular. And guess what? Because you're listening to Suspect Convictions, you can save $25 off on your first two orders, a $50 saving, by using the code SUSPECT at checkout. To get started, go to hungryroot.com. That's $25 each of the first two orders using SUSPECT at checkout. Once again, folks, go to hungryroot.com and enter the code SUSPECT to get $25 off on your first two orders. I'm just saying, go for it. You're going to enjoy this food. It's really good.
almost all of the paperwork concerning the gun and the arrest of Roland Burns disappeared from police files, but one copy of the report remained. It was misfiled in the New Orleans District Attorney's Office. Detective Venezia said he heard rumors on the street that Reginald Adams was involved in the murder. When Adams was arrested for an unrelated burglary a year later, Venezia questioned Reginald Adams about the Kathy Alfers homicide. Adams has contended that he was questioned for hours by detectives who gave him Valium and Miller beer. He has said during the interrogation, the detectives threatened to charge his wife in the burglary for which he was later acquitted. They also coached him on what to say during the tape-recorded interview, he said. Adams told detectives he had killed Kathy Alfers in a $10,000 hit job, but he got many of the basic facts of the murder wrong, including the caliber of the weapon, the victim's hair color, which door he told police he entered, and how many shots were fired. Adams said four. Alfers was shot seven times. He was tried and convicted for murder based solely on his confession. He was sent to Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, the largest maximum security prison in the United States, and place renowned for its violence and harsh conditions.
Well, a lot of people see it as sort of a vestige of slavery. It's an old plantation. It's surrounded by some really, by the Mississippi River on one side and some, you know, impenetrable like marshes and forest on the others. Very hard to get to, even harder, obviously, to get out of. Most of the people there are there for very lengthy sentences. You know, most of them, I would say, are life sentences.
For Reginald Adams, it was a terrifying place.
Your job is to protect yourself at any cost. And basically, that's what I was doing. I had a weapon and everything go with it. But the thing is, like I say, once they put you there, well, nobody care anyway. So, I mean, you actually... you're on your own. So I'm not going to sit here and say, well, hey, man, you know, ain't nobody going to bother you, this, that, because that'd be false on the truth. Angola is the city. And everything in that city are some of the same things they got out here, except for a gun. That's the only thing you don't have. But everything else, yes, Angola seems to get that. And most time, a lot of the free people, if you got money, free people bring you whatever you want, except a gun. So, I mean, if you're a free person, you're least suspected, unless somebody overhear you and decide to bat you off. But other than that, man, they got cell phones in prison. They got drugs in prison. They got just about everything they got out here, they got in prison. And they, like you say, it's a resourceful area. So it ain't like because you're in prison, none of these things don't exist no more. I thought that too, but like I say, I stayed away from a lot of that because after I was trying to put myself in a model position where if something did come along, maybe my name would come up, you know, so I stayed out of a lot of stuff. You know, when I first got there, I was into all kind of stuff. But after over the years, when I made trustee, I stopped all the foolishness, so... by me making a trustee, I said, well, yeah, recognize that. But that was like a smokescreen. They're sleeping, don't care nothing about no model prison. But you only tell yourself to change, and I've done that.
After more than 30 years in Angola, he wrote the New Orleans Innocence Project and asked it to review his case. In 2013, Innocence Project of New Orleans began investigating the case and discovered an NOPD supplemental report located in an unrelated file in the DA's office. The report revealed that the homicide detectives had discovered a murder weapon, traced it to the people who had access to the gun shortly before the murder, had subsequently arrested one of them, on whom they found a bracelet stolen from the victim's home, for accessory to first-degree murder, all within 1 month of the crime. This report was intentionally suppressed by the prosecutors and made it clear that the NOPD detectives had perjured themselves on the stand. IPNO presented its findings to the DA's office, which agreed that Mr. Adams' conviction and sentence should be vacated. 10 days later, on May 12, 2014, Mr. Adams was exonerated. In a press release, District Attorney Leon Cannizzaro apologized to Mr. Adams, saying the handling of this case was shameful. Not only did the prosecutor's intentional acts harm Reginald Adams, who was wrongfully incarcerated for more than 3 decades, but also it denied this community any opportunity to hold the real perpetrator criminally responsible for this violent crime.
You know, Reginald had absolutely no connection with. And the reports that we uncovered indicate that they had it tested by 2 ballistics experts with the New Orleans Police Department, and they indicated that it was a match. And, you know, that gun and the reports and the ballistic reports, you know, all disappeared and were never produced to Reginald or his attorneys at the time of his trials.
So this begs the question of why? I mean, you're a former federal prosecutor. You've had a lot of experience in that area. I would assume with official corruption and other things. I mean, I guess the question that comes to mind is, I mean, were they covering up for a bad cop, or what was going on?
I think that's the likely explanation. I mean, it's the only one that has ever made any sense to me. You know, the homicide detectives did actual real detective work in building a case against Ronald Ulfers, and they just ignored it. When they found all the stolen car parts for Kathy's divorce attorney, they probably messed up with their search warrant, you know, where they found those car parts, and that evidence was suppressed. And I think from that point forward, they simply ignored the obvious and, you know, went looking for someone else to pin this murder on. And unfortunately, Reginald presented himself.
That's a pretty horrible thing to do. I mean, put somebody away for life for murder that didn't do it. I mean...
Oh, it's incomprehensible.
For a man who spent nearly 34 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, Reginald Adams surprisingly lacks bitterness.
You know, I know animosity never sleeps, but in my position, I feel like animosity, nobody can win that on either side. You know, it's about moving forward. Had I not won the judgment, I'd still be the same person moving forward. Because, I mean, being free is everything. You can't sit around with a chip on your shoulder. Oh, man, I don't like this. Now, it doesn't add up to anything. So why carry that burden? I mean, you're free. You know, try to find your spot in this world and get in it, man, and be a productive citizen, whatever you feel like you were capable of doing, you know. And that's the frame of mind I got right now today. It ain't about the money. It's about being free and be able to make choices. You don't have choices in prison. None of that. So, and I'm pretty good with that. You know where I'm at? So I'm blessed.
I'm Scott Reeder, creator of Suspect Convictions. I'm joined today by our narrator, Michelle Ben-Simon, who is a Canadian, a superb musician, and a true crime buff. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, a lot of times people wonder about who are these people who are on these podcasts. So tell us, I mean, I got to listen to some of your music last week. Tell us about your band.
Yeah, so I'm in a band that's kind of influenced by a lot of, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s music and current music. And we tour everywhere, which is very, very fun. And yeah, it's just been great. And I'm also a true crime buff and have been very, very fascinated by all these stories that, you know, we do every week and trying to understand human relationships. And I mean, when I'm writing music as well, I focus a lot on human relationships and things. And I find it's, you know, it's not so far off from what we talk about in a lot of ways.
So what's the name of your band?
Cave Boy.
Okay. Okay. Well, what did you make of the story? I mean, it's a pretty sad one, wouldn't you say?
It's extremely sad. And again, you know, as we see time and time again, the evidence that points so clearly somewhere else seems to get brushed under the rug and someone's life is completely ruined and it's tragic.
What was so disturbing to me was the level of corruption within the New Orleans Police Department. You know, even when I talked to the detective that's accused of doing all these bad things, And I ask him, well, why didn't you go after this guy who you found to have the gun? And he's like, well, they were trying to frame him, the New Orleans Police Department. I'm thinking, so your defense against the accusation that you framed someone is that they were trying to frame somebody else.
Right.
I mean, that says to me the police department frames people. And you kind of have to ask yourself, well, why should I trust anything coming out of that department?
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that struck me was, and I didn't really touch on this during the narrative part of the program, but I think it's worth noting, is what happened to the different players in this story. You know, you had this police detective. He ended up leaving the department, I mean, being forced off the department because he pistol whipped his son and fired several shots. And he got into trouble for that. And then eventually he was convicted of vehicular homicide in Florida. You have the prosecutor in this case, who later becomes a judge and gets federally prosecuted in another case involving framing somebody for a crime.
Oh my God.
And then you have, you know, the police officer who was married to this Kathy Elfers who was killed. He kills his second wife and he's serving time. I think it's a life sentence at Angola Penitentiary where Reginald Fields did his 34 years. And it's like, this is just weird. I mean, almost everybody who was supposed to be on the right side of all this has ended up in prison.
Absolutely. And was Adams there at the same time as her husband?
Yes, he was. And I asked him if he knew him. And he said, no, they never met. He said they keep the police officers who have been convicted of felonies and sent to Angola in a special unit away from the other prisoners just for their own safety.
Right. That makes sense. Even though who was the most unsafe one between the two of them in this situation? It's funny, they keep the police officers safe, and yet the one who was innocent was, you know, in the most intense conditions.
And that place is scary. I mean, it's a former slave plantation that was converted into a prison. It's about 18,000 acres. And they sentenced people, most of the people who go there are serving life sentences for murder. And they send them there and they don't expect them to ever leave. I mean, they have a wood shop there that builds caskets to bury the inmates there at the prison. I mean, it is a scary, scary place. And it's very violent, very dangerous. And, you know, here's this city kid coming in at 24 years old. Reginald doesn't know anything about farming, and he's suddenly on a plantation where they're forcing inmates to pick cotton and then work in the fields and do all this stuff. It's almost like something you would expect before the Civil War. You know, people under being mandated to do work, I mean, for no pay. I mean, it just seems almost like slavery in a lot of ways. Now, obviously, most of the people there have committed crimes, and yes, you can force people to do involuntary servitude under the U.S. Constitution if you've committed a crime. But it just is mind-boggling that people within the New Orleans Police Department plotted to send an innocent man to prison for the rest of his life. I mean, that's what only thing I can come up with out of this is, you know, the DA's office said this was handled horribly. They immediately got him released. Once they came across these documents 34 years later. But gosh, I mean, I don't know. I mean, one of the questions I have for you is, do you think there was any measure of justice done for Kathy Elfers?
Absolutely not. I mean, her husband is in prison for another crime, but I feel like the more and more we see these innocent, you know, we've seen other cases where, you know, there's a victim who's still alive, and then the wrong person is sent to prison, and then eventually it's corrected. But I think that person goes on believing that they've found some sort of closure. But then there is that guilt on that person as well. And in this case, Kathy Alford is not alive, but I don't think that justice really gets served the same way that it would if the victim was alive.
I agree with you. And, you know, the other thing to remember is there's nobody that's been ultimately convicted in this crime now. It remains an open case. The brother and sister who they found to have possession of the gun have since died during the last 34 years. The husband, who it would sure look interesting to look at him, considering his conduct after his wife was murdered, that is, he murdered his second wife. He's serving a life in prison, but you kind of think, well, if he did this first crime, which we don't know for sure, but if he did it and they pursued him as a suspect, he would never have had the opportunity to kill a second wife.
Absolutely.
And certainly his second wife never got justice out of this case. She wasn't protected. Society wasn't protected if that was the case. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me that people, when they look at these cases, just see the wrong person who went to prison, but they don't see that the right person didn't go to prison. So it's a double whammy. I mean, it's not just that society let somebody down and sent somebody to prison that shouldn't have gone. It's that society let down the victim by sending the wrong person.
Yeah, and left it open for something else to happen, which in this case it did, whether we know that it was him or not, or if he had ties to the brother and sister. I don't know that we'll ever know those answers.
I don't think we ever will. I mean, it's pretty hard to prosecute a case 34 years after the fact.
And it's a big number. That always is what blows my mind, is how long these people are left and kept in prison. I mean, I guess I understand that, you know, these files get buried, but that misfile, how was that never noticed in 34 years? Like, they just get put away in these boxes and never looked at again while people are just rotting in prison. And it's tragic that there's no system that's in place to make sure that these things don't happen. And why were all those files destroyed, the other ones? I mean, luckily this one file was misfiled and not destroyed, but if it hadn't been found, there's possibly no way that they could have found any innocence for Adams.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I've gone through this all the time when I'm doing investigations. Like, I'll file a Freedom of Information Act request with a county for the trial transcripts and for the you know, the evidence, and I'll be told, oh, we don't have those anymore. We lost them 30 years ago, or we lost them 20 years ago. Never mind, the guy is still in prison. It's just this kind of passivity among government officials on this. Like, oh, well, he's in prison. We don't need to worry about keeping those files for him. We don't need to worry about maintaining the evidence. Never mind that 20 years later or 30 years later, they may come up with reasons to believe he's innocent and want to review those documents. And a lot of times they're long gone. I mean, there's a kind of a cavalier view, I mean, among a lot of guardians of public documents about maintaining that stuff in the past. It's disturbing to me. And in this case, I don't think it was just a question of being cavalier. I think it was a question about being deliberate. They didn't care. I mean, they wanted those documents gone. They wanted them thrown away. And I think it's just bizarre that this was covered up.
What do you want in a true crime podcast?
Do you want well-researched material, but an easy-to-follow format?
Do you want a bit of dark humor, but want sensitive topics handled, well, sensitively?
Do you want hosts who are lactose intolerant, but eat macaroni and cheese anyway?
Well, I think you might be looking for us. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca, and we're the hosts of the true crime podcast, Yours in Murder. And this isn't any old true crime podcast. I have a background in forensic science.
And I have a background in journalism, so we're able to combine our knowledge and bring you interesting new perspectives on cases.
Not that we're all serious. We have a bit of a dark sense of humor.
Just a bit. I mean, we like morbid jokes and cat jokes.
Lots of cat jokes. So if you're looking for something new and a bit out of the ordinary, check out Yours in Murder.
You can find us on all of your favorite podcatchers, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and TuneIn.
You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at yoursinmurder.net.
We hope to see you soon, and until next time, we are Yours in Murder.